Hello, everyone, and a very warm welcome to this podcast, Yovana the Ageless, where our mission is to unleash everything about living ageless in collaboration with the experts in ancient healing practices from all across the world. Yovana the Ageless is an experiential ancient lifestyle online platform with focus on ageless living. This space has emerged from our innate desire to impart knowledge and experience on living ageless at body, mind, and consciousness level. Yovana ecosystem is all about knowledge sharing and living a traditional lifestyle driven from a medley of worldly timeless wisdom of yoga, Ayurveda, traditional Chinese medicine, microbiotics, Qigong, and raw alkaline and living food philosophy. At Yovana, we share this timeless wisdom in collaboration with experts through this podcast and courses on our Yovana platform conducted by global experts in ancient modalities. On this platform, we discuss everything from foods to rituals to lifestyle to yogic and ancient movement practices like Qigong, Ayurveda, and much more. Here you learn to live a way of life to regain Yovana, the youth, living by the Rith, the universal order of healing and agelessness. We invite you to realize the divinity of your innate potential to remain ageless with us on this platform, Yovana. Good evening, everyone, and thank you so much for joining us yet again at Yovana the Ageless podcast. And I have a very special guest today, Bill Tara, who is one of the proponents of natural living, macrobiotic diet, and correlates a lot of, you know, mind activity with the foods. And he has this experience of 50 plus years into understanding how foods and mind are correlated. So thank you so much, Bill, for being here and, you know, sharing your experience with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you. It's all my pleasure. And so I'll just introduce you first, and then we would really want to know, you know, your journey, and
great.
And gradually we'll dive deeper into, you know, how foods and mind come together. So Bill Tara has been an active advocate of natural health since 1967 and is a pioneer in the modern macrobiotic movement in America and Europe. With over 50 years of experience, Bill has been in the forefront on natural health revolution. He was the vice president of a trading company, one of the America's first distributors of natural organic foods, and was a co-founder of Sunwheel Natural Foods in London. Bill is also an author, and he has some amazing books out there. So, Bill, I would really would want to also talk about your books, specifically, you know, Macrobiotics and Human Behavior, which is, you know, I'm kind of getting very keen interest into that book. So probably I'll be having that book and, you know, diving deeper
Great.
Into it. But now over to you. Help us understand, you know, who you are, how did you got into all of this, and, you know, ultimately landed understanding mind and foods together.
Well, I was introduced to macrobiotics in 1966, and I was living in San Francisco at the time, and my business partner was given a book by George Oshawa, Japanese philosopher, and it was very interesting to me because I had a great interest in Chinese philosophy and Japanese Buddhism, Taoism. It was interesting because I had never seen the connection before between those philosophies and any kind of practical application. It was always philosophical or spiritual. And so I was interested in it, and I decided to give it a try and see what it was all about. And after I started eating this way, I noticed some very profound changes, first of all, in my physical health, because I had some health problems at the time. I didn't start macrobiotics for that reason, but I noticed that my digestion and the pain that I was having in my stomach was going away, was diminishing. And I went to my doctor, and I had ulcers. And
okay.
I had a battery of tests run about 2 months after I started macrobiotics. And when I went back to get the conclusions of the tests, they told me that the ulcers had disappeared.
Wow.
And I was very
and
surprised.
This was in how much time?
About 2 months.
Oh, wow.
In a very short period of time. And I had serious ulceration. They had told me that when I was older, I would probably have to have surgery to have a portion of my stomach removed. And I was very impressed with that. But my doctor was not impressed. in fact, she told me that she thought it was just a coincidence and that it had nothing to do with anything that I did. And of course, I knew differently.
I knew what I did
and what happened. And so I decided to take macrobiotics a little bit more seriously. And the second big thing that happened to me was probably even more important than the first. And that was, I decided that I couldn't, in George Osawa's books, he always talked about this fasting diet, number 7 diet.
Yeah, and that is one of my questions.
Right. And so I decided to give that a try, but I knew I couldn't do it in the city. If I was around my old lifestyle, it would be too difficult for me. So I went into the mountains and I went back into the woods and I camped and I ate nothing but brown rice and drank tea for, actually, it was over 10 days because I had taken in more rice. And so I thought I might as well stay until the food runs out.
Abel, I have a question here, like for somebody in today's times, listening to this and thinking of going ahead with this kind of fasting with brown rice and, various other only things coming together. So a lot of people have this thought of, calorie deficient or maybe, protein deficient. And a lot of these thoughts are actually a part of modern thought process, and people actually are not very convenient trying these really cleansing kind of diets and all. So what's your say on that?
Well, I don't recommend that people do that kind of extreme fasting now until they've been more experienced. I was uneducated, and I'm glad that I was.
Ignorance is bliss.
I did. And also, I was much younger. I was 24 years old. I was more hardy. I didn't have, even though I had these ulcers, other than that, I was in good health. I was a very active person. And, I used to go mountaineering a lot. And, I was raised on the seacoast. And so I surfed and, I was involved in a lot of different physical activities. But the thing that happened on my fast was that I had this change in the way that I felt in terms of my cognition. I felt like my mind was calmer, and that when I got back into my life again, I felt that I was more friendly with other people. I just felt that my whole attitude changed so dramatically. And that was really much more impressive to me than the ulcers. It was totally, totally unexpected. And it really, I think that it really colored the way that I approached macrobiotics over the years. It's been 56 years now. And even though I have counseled and been teaching for a long period of time, part of my focus has always been on the connection between what we eat and what goes on in our mind and what goes on spiritually, if you will, with macrobiotics. And so all of the things about nutrition and all of that, I've always had a prejudice to approach those things in terms of how is this affecting not only my physical structure, but how is this affecting the way that my brain works, right? Mm-hmm. And so,
Can I ask a question here? So if we look at the macrobiotic philosophy from where you actually got this exposure of how foods are impacting the mind, and if we get deeper into the ancient understanding of how Ayurveda has always looked at human beings, it's always been a mind-body connect. And
like
macrobiotics has its own way of figuring out, how foods are impacting the mind. Similarly, there's a concept of mind energies, 3 different energies, which Ayurveda talks about, which is sattva, rajas, and tamas, which is the balancing energy. Sattva and rajas is the aggressive energy, tamas is the inertia kind of an energy. So if I look into all these ancient cultures, whether it be Ayurveda or macrobiotics or traditional Chinese medicine, always had that view that food is energy and it has a specific kind of an effect on the mind. Why is it that the science is not able to catch up with this thought, if this is such a strong thought?
Well, there is a lot of modern science that points in that direction. I mean, there are a number of things that we could look to that are, if we look at it from a Western point of view or a nutritional point of view. One is that for the last 20 years, there's been a lot of discussion about the enteric nervous system, which is a portion of the nervous system that generates out of the gut and goes directly to the brain. Now, the enteric system is not, it's not a thinking brain, but it's an acting brain. In other words, it has a huge influence on our emotions, on our state of mind, and on general cognition. You know, so that's, you might say that's the vibrational quality of our intellect.
Yeah.
And that's very much in scientific literature. That's not a new theory. Mm-hmm. Although Michio Kushi and George Oshawa were teaching that long, long ago, right? They were teaching that 50 years ago, 60 years ago, that gut-brain connection.
Which is phenomenal. Like there was no science at that time, no researches at that time, and still there
and we know now that certain hormones like serotonin are produced primarily in the intestine, and that's what modern nutritionists sometimes refer to as the feel-good chemicals. You know,
exactly.
So
yeah.
You know, we know that if serotonin is being produced in the body at the right volume, we have a feeling. We have a tendency to feel more calm, more in harmony with our environment.
Exactly.
And then on the other end of it, Western nutrition has started to look more and more at phytonutrients. These are small components of major nutrients, and realize that the modern diet is very low on phytonutrients, and these are substances which particularly affect neurotransmission. Mm-hmm. So if you're low on phytonutrients, what happens is that cognition is more difficult. The brain has to struggle more to process information. And those phytonutrients, including flavonoids, for instance, are mostly found in fruits and vegetables.
Yeah.
they're not very much found in meats and dairy food at all. And so you have all of these, the interesting thing is that modern nutrition has moved closer and closer to what we've been teaching and what's been taught in traditional forms of medicine, all over the East particularly, but also in ancient Greece and parts of the ancient world. We're all knew that, right? That was, but the problem is that has not been translated into practice. So theoretically, we can understand that the food that we eat has an enormous effect on the way that our mind works the way our senses work. But on the other hand, that hasn't trickled down into the practice of medicine the way that doctors are operating.
Exactly. So this is actually I was coming on to, because like, you know, in pandemic, it was actually a real test of how, you know, the brains of people actually work, like with a lot of stress coming in and emotional issues coming in. So the field of psychology actually still, I think it mostly relates to the medication or the therapy part. It still does not actually very actively include specific, you know, diet. What do we call it? Like it's a diet therapy, or it's a complete changeover of your diet?
No, it probably won't for a long time. But the whole area of psychology as opposed to psychiatry, right? There's an interesting split there. You know, I mean, psychiatrists have always been preferential toward drug treatment of mental disturbance, and psychology has been more about talking cures and group process and things like that. I'm afraid that the bias that exists in psychology and psychiatry is one that is not very promising. The things that are promising in psychology have to do with behavioral psychology, which is like retraining habits. And I think that as psychology has developed, because I was very active in the 1970s and 80s in London with the personal growth movement, and that was more like gestalt therapy and bioenergetics and things like that. And there is a physical component there, but the physical component has more to do with the way that the body holds stress and how you release stress. it in my book, particularly in the new edition of my book, which will be out at the end of this month, I talk quite a bit about that, because that patterning of holding stress is certainly helped by changing your diet, but it's not the end of the road. You have to also change your habits, and you also have to have physical activity. If you don't have physical activity, you don't break down those patterns of held stress in the body.
Exactly. So Bill, help me understand, like when you experienced that, or that thing clicked you, like, you know, there is some change in your thought process, or what actually worked for you when you went on to this diet. What were the initial changes that you had experienced? Like, you know, calmness you mentioned, or a sense of more connectivity is what you mentioned. How quick was that? Like, you know, I believe you must be on the diet for about 10 days.
Well, I think that part of the thing that happens with health is that if you look at health as an end game, if you look at it as something, oh, now I'm going to get healthy and then I'm going to be healthy and then I don't have to be concerned anymore, you create problems. Health is an ongoing process. No, I'm 80 years old and I'm still learning about my health week to week, month to month, year to year. No, because you have to incorporate things. You have to find out where your patterns are, your patterns of behavior, and learn how to alter those or change those. And that's not easy for human beings, because we're characters of habit.
Exactly.
We have things that we do and we think, okay, I like doing that. And so I just keep doing it over and over and over again. And oftentimes those habits that we develop over time are not productive of health. They make us feel comfortable in the short run, but not in the long run.
Exactly. And I guess these habits only tomorrow culminate into maybe, you know, all these lab parameters going up and down and, you know, imbalances starting to show up. So my next question, Bill, is related to the specific thing only, like in the modern way of eating, and lifestyle, what do you think are the greatest imbalances which are impacting the minds of the people? I'm not talking of the people who are depressed or who are in a low state. I'm talking of people in, you know, having that generic behavior where either they might be really have that aggressive kind of personality, or maybe a very, you know, inertia or low kind of a personality. So these are like two different extremes. But what do you think is causing that imbalance, whether it is diet or lifestyle?
Well, everything about health is about balance. And the question that sometimes does not get asked, and that is, balance with what? You don't have balance in a vacuum, right? You have balance with something. And the something that we have to create balance with is our environment. And it's not only our personal environment, like our society, our family, etc., but it's also nature.
Yeah.
And the whole history of humanity is a history of our relationship with the environment. How do we think about the environment, and how do we treat the environment? And right now, I have to say that the things that we talk about and we identify as global warming or environmental destruction, these things are not abstract. These things are very real. We will not make ourselves healthy until we help create a healthy environment, because right now what we're doing is destroying the environment. And every health issue, every nutritional issue is related back to that. You know, for instance, if we look at something like, if we look at all the things that cause major illness in human beings, in the food chain, they're all things that are environmentally destructive. You know, the raising and killing of animals, the taking all the fish out of the ocean, you know, the way that we abuse cattle so that we can get their milk, the way that we farm products so that we kill the soil that they grow in. These are all huge environmental factors. And so the foods that are healthy foods are foods that are generally healthy foods for the environment as well as us. In other words, we could sustain ourselves on those foods. And some might think that that's too much of a philosophical approach, but I think that it's the future of nutrition.
Exactly.
The future of nutrition is saying, like, how can we feed all the people? We have 8 billion people, and it'll be 10 billion in the blink of an eye, right? 10 yeah. billion people. How do we feed all these people in a healthy way so that they are healthy? And the solution is the kind of diet that you're talking about and that I'm talking about and my wife Marlene is talking about. It's a modified macrobiotic diet, which takes into account seasonal eating. It takes into account all of those factors, which are large factors about nutrition, the economics of nutrition, the damage that bad food has in terms of creating health problems.
That's a very deep thought for sure. So, but I would really now, want to get into the technical stuff. When, it's scientifically known that foods can change our blood chemistry. So, how does that impact the mind?
I'm sorry, I didn't get that. Food changes what?
Food can change our blood chemistry.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's actually going on when we say that food can change our blood chemistry? How can a common man understand or absorb this thought?
Well, I think that that's one of the easiest things for people to realize. I mean, why do people drink a cup of coffee? Why do people have a drink of alcohol? Why do people, when they get sad, why do they want to eat ice cream? These are not mysteries. These are common things. If people drink coffee because it makes them stimulated. They drink alcohol because it makes them lose their inhibitions. So what's happening there? They're changing their blood chemistry, which changes their brain chemistry. It's a very direct connection. There's no mystery around that. And so then you just have to imagine, well, if those things are true, which we know them to be true, if those things are true, what happens to what I had for breakfast? Does that affect my mind? Well, of course it must. It's logical. Right? Yeah. There's just an organic logic to that. In fact, the amazing thing is that we don't know that.
Right? That's very beautifully said, Bill, because my next question is actually related to this only. In the modern way of life, as you mentioned, whether it be alcohol or coffee or any other kind of a stimulant that we would want to have, the whole idea is we are just trying to gain that high. I mean, whether it is you want to take a break from work or it's entertainment or what, we are trying to attain that high. And you having lived this way of life, and I'm also on that path. I mean, just, I am quite a beginner for now. But yeah, I've experienced those changes that you were talking about. And even I realized that you get a high when you start to live by the principles of how macrobiotics defines how the diet should be. And this high is way better high than what you get from alcohol or the stimulant foods. So what's your say on this understanding? And, I'll tell you where I'm coming from. So very interesting incidents. So, there was a time when I used to consume alcohol and we went to a friend's place. And that was the time I was practicing macrobiotics also. And I got into yoga as well. And before that, gradually the shift happened. One fine day, they just offered me alcohol, and my body did not just feel like having it. There was no reason, but my body didn't. And I was feeling very already on that high. So this friend comes and tells me that, okay, have some, you'll feel really good and you'll have that high. I told him, why don't you go do this practice of eating right foods and practicing yoga for 2 hours in a day, you'll feel much more high. So, but to explain this feeling to somebody who tries to gain this high from, say, stimulants is a very different thing. So, how to kind of put it across to a common man to help them understand, there's a different approach to how you can actually learn to feel a different way, and which is also a very good kind of a high. I mean, very different from what you get from alcohol or other stimulants.
Well, I think that I'm going to approach this from two ways. Sure. One is, the reason that we have these kind of habits is because they make us feel good. There's no such thing as a habit that doesn't make you feel good. If the worst habit you could have makes you feel good, right? Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you wouldn't do it, right? You
keep
doing it because it makes you feel good. So with food, one of the problems is that most of our food habits have to do with the production of dopamine. which is one of those constructs, a chemical construct in the body, that is a very valuable one. And it's one that gives us pleasure. So when we eat certain things, we get pleasure. Now, the human condition has been, in terms of nutrition, has been vastly influenced by three different things nutritionally. One of them is sweetness, sugar. The other is fat, right? anything that's fatty, and the third is salty. Right?
Yeah.
So those three things, and the rationale for this is very simple, and that is that as we were evolving, those things were very rare for human beings to eat. We say, well, the fat could have been available. It wasn't. When you're eating wild animals, you're not eating a lot of fat. You know, they don't have a lot of fat on them. They run away. You know, they're very active. Yeah. They're not overeating. Honey, maybe bees once in a while. But most of the sweetness that we are familiar with is processed sweetness. You know, we squeeze the sugar cane or we squeeze the sugar beet or whatever we do to get the sweetness out. So these things are very powerful. And dopamine is a chemical that produces habitual behavior. When you have something and it stimulates dopamine, you say, wow, that was good. I want to have more of that. But there's a trap there. And that is that you can never get the same feeling again. You hit a threshold. It can only make you feel so good. So one of the things that happens when people change their diet is that they have to re-educate their body so that they get a dopamine response from eating a piece of fruit rather than having a candy bar.
But I guess this is actually the biggest struggle, because once you've crossed that threshold and you've started to eat right and you start to experience what changes are happening, then it's quite easy. But for somebody who's already used to that kind of a feeling, deriving it from the kind of foods that create imbalance, that initial step is the biggest challenge. So, you know, how can a common person really learn to kind of very smoothly transition towards
people have to want to change. You know, you can't, when you say that, you use the phrase a common man a couple of times, right? Okay.
Yeah.
So first of all, common man. But when you're talking to people about health, about food, they have the want to change. And the habits that we're talking about, these are addictions.
Yeah.
I've worked with addicts and it's exactly the same working with an addict or working with somebody that's stuck on sugar. It's exactly the same. It may be more extreme in the symptoms, but it's exactly the same. And there are a couple of rules. One is the person has to know that they want to change, that what they're doing is not good for them. If they don't know that they're not feeling well or that they're sick, they're not going to change.
Yeah.
You can give them all the philosophy in the world and they won't change. So people have to want to change. The second thing is that nutrition works very quickly. You know, I always tell people, and Marlene does this too, I always tell people, they say, well, I don't know if I could do this forever. I say, don't worry about forever. Forever is a long time, right?
Yeah.
Let's give us 21 days or give us 6 weeks, depending on the problem, because within 21 days or within 40 days, the whole gut biome is going to be completely transformed. And almost always what happens if people really apply the dietary principles within that period of time, they experience an improvement in health always. No matter what the problem is, right? They experience an improvement of health.
Yeah, I agree to that.
Then it's very simple. Do you want to continue the improvement, or do you want to go back to feeling the way that you felt before?
Exactly. So I guess this is also a matter of having raised your consciousness to a different level where you know what you're doing and you know why you're doing it, right? And again, I would again go back to the ancient cultures where this philosophy is a very deep-rooted aspect of yoga philosophy, traditional Chinese medicine philosophy, and even Ayurveda philosophy. Again, you know, now these ancient cultures knew that how consciousness drives you on the right path. And this aspect, I believe, is quite missing in modern way of thinking and, you know, living. So again, you know, my first question would be, where do you think is the gap in that consciousness, raised consciousness? And secondly, what is the path to, of course, food is one of the paths, but apart from food, what is the path so that, you know, one starts to raise their level of consciousness?
Well, I think that, look, we have to eat and we have to move our bodies, right? Those two things are fundamental, right? And yeah. if we're eating well and we're moving our body and we're breathing, right? If we get under breath, right? Yeah. Then what's left? Well, you know, there we get into an area of philosophy, you know, or spiritual practice, either one, right? Either philosophy yeah. or spiritual practice. And that means that people have to have a desire for self-improvement that goes beyond just getting rid of their symptoms. Because we focused very much on symptoms, and even dealing with macrobiotics in terms of health counseling, we have clients all the time who they approach macrobiotics the same way they would approach medicine. In other words, they say, like, okay, how can I get rid of this problem that I have, right? Say I have acid stomach, or say I have constipation. How can I get rid of this? If you tell them how to get rid of that and they do it and they get rid of the constipation, then they think, okay, that's it. I'm cured now.
Yeah, I'm done. Yeah.
I'm done now. Now I can go back. I mean, we had a situation this last year where somebody who had cancer and a very serious form of cancer, and we see quite a few people who have cancer, very, very serious developed case, and we gave them a program and they said, well, this is really great. I'm going to start doing this after the holidays. So that was like 3 weeks before Christmas, right?
Wow.
Because the holidays, I know that I'm going to want to eat meat and I'm going to want to drink
wine.
And I
guess this is a very common, common thing. I mean, most of the people would come with this thought that, you know, maybe I'll start tomorrow. There would be some reason why not to start.
Yeah, that's why we don't negotiate. We're quite happy to tell people, okay, well, then you're just putting your life on the line, you know, do what you want to do.
Right? And I guess that's how it has to be tackled, because, you know, that has to be understood this way or that way. There's no in between.
Absolutely. Because you can't, if you want results from something, you have to do it. You know, yeah. you can't learn to sing without singing.
Exactly.
You can't learn to swim without getting wet, you know. You have to engage in the activity.
Exactly. Right. So, coming back to this number 7 diet, help us understand what exactly it is and, you know, how to go about it, if at all we should be going about it.
Well, the way that George Osawa put this forward in the 1950s, in 1940s, he approached this as a way of fasting. So it was seen as a fast. So instead of cutting out all food, he said, just have the most simple food there is, but have the most, what he considered to be the most central or balanced food. And that was brown rice. So just eat brown rice for 10 days and see how you feel, right? And I still think it's a good thing to do, but you have to be sensible too. If you're a person who's weakened by illness, if you're a person who is, a very old age, like me, right?
No, I don't think you're in that category.
if you, there's certain things there that probably, if it doesn't really appeal to you, if it's not good to you, you probably shouldn't do it. But the important thing is that if you just eat a simple diet, that's the same kind of thing. If you've been eating junk food for 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, just switching to grains, beans, vegetables, nuts, seeds, and beans, that's like a fast for you. That's a huge change, a big shift. And you will notice a difference from it. And it's that difference that you can start to be aware of the effect that food has on your body.
Yeah, so in continuation to the same conversation, a lot of people have this emotional eating habit. Like it's a habit. It's a, you know, instinct that's coming out of you. How to deal with it?
Well, you have to if the person really is, if it's really a pathology, you have to deal with it by helping them identify why they do that, right? Okay, what are the triggers? What makes you do that, right? Whether it is it something to do with your relationship with other people? Is it your relationship with your the work that you have? Is it something that happens in your environment? Right? Whatever. But you only break a habit by breaking a habit. And the best way to break a habit is by getting a new habit. So myself personally, I don't concentrate on a big psychological profile for people. Think, look, don't worry about that right now. Just do this. As long as you're eating good food, the food which you're recommending to them, as long as you're eating that diet, and as long as you're getting a certain amount of activity every day, don't worry about the other problem. Just don't worry about it. Even if you have ice cream, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. You're just going to do this every day. The more you do that every day, the more your system starts to change, and the more your mentality starts to change. And I found that to be true. And even dealing with people who have very, very serious emotional difficulties, you know, and again, it all boils down to how much the person wants to change. Yeah. They either want to change or they don't want to change. And in the final analysis, you're not going to have any influence on that, or you're going to have minimal influence on it.
I agree to that. Yes, that's absolutely correct. So, I would really want to, you know, discuss the comparison between how modern nutrition looks at foods, which is, more about counting the foods, the nutrients that you're consuming. And there's a lot of focus in today's times about these many nutrients. And now this focus is getting even more deeper, getting into the level of antioxidants, trying to figure out, okay, this antioxidant for liver and this one for this place and this place. So, and we are just, you know, stuck in that vicious cycle. How can somebody eat like that and the impact on the mind?
One of the things that's interesting, I think, is you're probably familiar with Colin Campbell, who wrote the China study.
Yes.
Okay. Colin is probably, I think he's the most enlightened nutritionist on the planet.
There's no doubt about that.
And his latest thinking, his latest book, is about how analytical science has failed in nutrition. You can't analyze, you can't use that analytic method to really comprise a good diet, because that's not the way that we have evolved as human beings, as an organism, in getting nutrients into our body. You know, so as I'm sure you know, and probably many of your listeners know, when you eat a food that has a particular nutrient, and let's take sugar for example, when you eat something like an apple or a pear or a piece of fruit, there's sugar in there, but also there are minerals and vitamins that help to balance that. And there's fiber in there, which help to slow down the digestion of it. So we're used to getting food in that way. And we've been doing that for hundreds of thousands of years, for millions of years. Right? That's the way the body is designed to operate. If you try to take, if you say, okay, well, what I want to do is I want to take the protein out of this. So I take the protein out and I put it in a pill and I give you the pill, right? And then you have protein. Say, that's it, I'm getting protein now. But you're not getting all of the other elements that are necessary for metabolizing that protein. And so you create a deficiency, actually. So the modern diet is a diet that produces more deficiency than it does productivity. And part of this is the whole approach of analysis in Western medicine and reductionism, reducing everything down. And I have to say that as modern day human beings, we're very easily fooled in that way. We're tricked in that way because we think, oh my God, this is so, I must need zinc, right? I must need more vitamin C. Well, you can't do that. You go crazy and you won't get healthy.
That's what makes me think, like, I don't know if you must have heard of this this new modality, which is functional medicine, which is about, you know, getting even more deeper into figuring out these micronutrients and all those supplements available for
It's a fool's game. It is a fool's game. If I go back to what I was saying before about the environment, that's the way that we create a new nutritional paradigm. That does this food make sense in terms of our biology and in terms of our relationship to the natural world? Is this food make any sense or not? If the food uses up excessive resources in order to produce it, if it creates pollution as a byproduct, if it produces death as a byproduct, well then why would we be eating it? The only reason would be short-term pleasure.
Exactly.
And you know, and our culture is so much keyed on that that it's almost insane. Right, because we're always looking for the quick fix, right? How can I get a quick fix?
Yeah, but I have a very practical question. I think because I face this question a lot, like now being on the other side of understanding foods, which is very different understanding from modern nutrition, and people coming over for their transformation are still have that kind of an understanding. That okay, modern nutrition talks these many calories, this much protein, and all of that. So, how are you able to bridge in that gap? Because that level of understanding from where you are coming and from where the client is coming is there's a huge gap in there, right?
Well, that becomes easier all the time. I mean, when I started doing this, you know, over five decades ago, there wasn't any science that backed up what we were doing.
Yeah.
Or there was very little. There was a little bit, but not much. Now, you can, if somebody has a direct Western nutritional question about eating a vegan macrobiotic diet, there's tons of research. If the people are really serious, they can get all the research they want. You know, and every major health organization in the world now, including the World Health Organization, including the American Dietetic Association, including the Center for Disease Control, really conservative organizations, have stated that a diverse vegan diet is perfectly healthy for anybody of any age.
And full stop. That simplifies it all. I mean, you don't need to get into it.
So if a person wants to talk about where do I get my protein, where do I get my vitamin C, where do I get my this, which they don't know anything about anyway, right? Okay, because it's just an idea in their head, right? They think protein only lives in a hamburger and vitamin C only lives in an orange, right? Okay, but whatever question they have, there's an easy answer within contemporary science. And so the chasm is not as big as it was before. The chasm now is up here.
It's
the narrative that people have been taught over the years that is has been disproven now. But it's like living on a planet where people still think the Earth is flat. You know, I mean, how do you, if you've been around the world and you've seen it from an airplane and you've seen the curvature of the Earth,
the big picture.
And you go back and you tell people, no, it's not flat. It's this way. Here's a picture of it. It's still difficult to get through that.
So, I think coming back to our original topic, which was, you know, diet for the mind, practically, what do you think, of course, you know, macrobiotic diet, but a lot of listeners may not initially understand macrobiotic diet or macrobiotic vegan diet. So if you could just, you know, kind of break it down in a way where people can actually take back something and start implementing it.
Well, so a macrobiotic diet generally, and this will vary from person to person and from area to area, because we like to, as much as we can, we like to tailor a diet according to the environment that a person lives in, right? Okay, so given that, a macrobiotic diet is generally based around the consumption of cereal grains, whole cereal grains, and the secondary food group would be vegetables in terms of quantity, and the third would be beans. Now, those three types of vegetables, particularly grains and beans, those were used in every culture throughout the world, every agrarian culture throughout the world. And the vegetables would vary from culture to culture, in reflecting the environment, you know, what kind of vegetables and what kind of time of year they've grown, et cetera, et cetera. And then you have fruits, which are a minimal part of the macrobiotic diet, but are essential. You know, you have to have fruit. It's very important, and seeds and nuts. And seeds and nuts are an important addition, but again, in small quantities. And particularly with Marlene and I, because we don't add oil to our food, seeds and nuts are an important component of the diet, so that you're getting the fat, the natural fats that you need. Aside from that, you know, seaweeds are used in macrobiotics because they're an important adjunct, particularly now that food is not grown well. You know, even organically grown food is sometimes lacking in minerals. And sea vegetables have a lot of trace minerals in them. So even just a small, but it's not essential. You know, you can eat a macrobiotic diet and not have seaweed. You can eat a macrobiotic diet and not have some of the fermented bean products that are used in China and Japan, and which are very important foods, and I think should be produced all over the world. Yeah. But it's not essential. The essential things are grains, beans, and vegetables, right? And some of those vegetables should be raw or sprouted, but most of them should be cooked. And so one of the main differences between macrobiotics and a lot of popular dietary approaches is cooking. You know, we think that cooking is an absolute essential to get everything that you need out of your food. The reason human beings started cooking their food was so that they could use foods like grains and beans and some of the vegetables that have very strong stocks, because you soften the fiber of the food so that you can chew it better and so that you can digest it better. I think the lack of cooking has more to do with human laziness than it does with anything that's seriously, that's a serious nutritional consideration.
I agree to that. I mean in India also, like in my near and dear households only, see that cooking is something which is the last thing that anybody would want to do there.
You know, I gave a cooking class in India one time.
Oh, you've been to India?
In 1970, I gave a cooking class in New Delhi.
I am in New Delhi only.
Which was a riot, because it was I stayed in India for about 4 months. I was mostly on the other side of the continent, on around Calcutta in that area. Okay. But I was in Delhi, and Indian people that I met there asked me to come and do a talk, and I went and gave a talk, and then the sponsor, the person whose home I was staying in, said, "Oh, you should do a cooking class." And I said, "Oh," because I had only done about maybe 3 cooking classes in my life up to that point. And I said, "Well, okay, I'll do that." And so I went, and so the cooking class was all ladies. And you know, I was facing a group of ladies who I knew could cook much better than I could ever cook.
I mean, in a way, yes, but
and very experienced. But you know, they were very gracious, except that they all told me that I needed to put some spice in my food.
Yeah, that must be definitely coming in from Indian women. We use a lot of spices. But in a way, that's good. Also, what's your take on spices?
Well, I think that a little bit is fine. I think that spices all over the world is just one of those things that people have overdone. And I think that the therapeutic effect of spices was one of the things that was used traditionally. I don't know this for certain, but I have a feeling if you went back and back and back in Indian cuisine, you would find that most of the spices were used very modestly in food, and that many of them had therapeutic qualities, and that's why they were used. And then you start combining the spices and get hooked on the taste of them, and you know, all of a sudden it becomes curry, right? You know,
it's like, you know, going overboard with spices, and this is actually the fact of the matter. We are so used to those sharp tastes.
So I mean when I was in India, and I was when I was traveling around before I met people and started and I did a little bit of work in India, I had a client in India for a while, and I stayed in his house in Mumbai, right? before that, I had trouble finding places where I could eat, you know.
Because of the spice?
And I would tell people, I don't want any spice. And they would say, oh, okay. And they would bring me the food and I would eat and I would go, whoa, this is so hot. And then say, oh, no, there's no spice in there.
Yeah, that's definitely, we're quite high on spices. Yeah, I mean, if you look at Ayurveda nutrition, it's majorly about using tastes, you know, flavors and of course, use of spices, as you said, mildly, like, you know, just to enhance the energetic properties of the meat.
Yeah.
That should be about it. So,
and okay, it's the same in other countries too. I mean, you have the use of very hot foods in Mexico and South America. Part of that, particularly the very hot spices, has to do with just making the body sweat, you know, so that you can cool down, you know. So it's fine, but if you live in Alaska, it's probably not such a good idea.
yeah. So that kind of, you know, gives me another question. Like, do you think when somebody goes overboard with one specific kind of a taste or food, like somebody goes high on, say, animal food, or somebody is high on spicy foods, there is a specific mind pattern also going along with that?
Well, I think we all have our own tastes, the things that we like to do. And also, you know, in Chinese medicine, you have the five transformations. So, you know, a system that's similar to Ayurveda, you know, not the same, but similar, you know, so that you have certain body types that particularly like a particular taste or a particular food. And that's fine. But those differences are very moderate. They're not extreme. We get caught into extreme things to stabilize the boredom in our life sometimes, you know. I mean, I think a lot of what people do, of what we do, is to get some spice in our life, you know, to kind of stir
again, it's
up.
An emotional need which majorly gets fulfilled by the food that we
and have. You know, and there's nothing necessarily, in my mind anyway, wrong with that. It's whether it's done moderately or whether it's extreme.
Exactly.
You know,
when
we take things to an extreme, then they become very damaging.
So I guess that's the philosophy of macrobiotics also, just staying in the balance.
But I think macrobiotics is has kind of gone too far in the other direction sometimes. You know, I mean, when I first started macrobiotics, it was very, very strict. You know, and I appreciate that, and I think that there's a very good case for having that kind of discipline around your diet. But now,
don't you think that makes it restrictive? I mean, people don't like
that. Well, yes, but what is that restriction? I mean, I know people tell me sometimes when they look at what I eat and they say, oh, that diet's too restricted. And what it means is that I'm not eating meat and dairy, food and sugar.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, that's not a restriction for me. I think they're restricted because they don't have enough vegetables. You know, so it's a very relative kind of decision that you have to make. I think that in modern day macrobiotics, sometimes there have been things added in without thinking of the principles, without thinking in terms of yin and yang, and without thinking in terms of climate, without thinking in terms of condition. It's just, again, to make it tasty. And that's okay. I mean, you know, sometimes when we're exposing people to something new, we have to make it more familiar for them, you know. And so, you know, the kind of...
That's the beginning approach, and then gradually you can just...
That's okay, but except when the people that have been practicing for a long time are still doing that, and that's maybe not so good. Because I think that if you get too liberal with your practice, what happens is you lose your center.
And then it becomes a habit.
And it becomes something like, oh, it's not a big deal, you know, this and that and the other thing. And we live in a very interesting time, you know. I mean, the things that we do on a day-to-day basis affect the world we live in. And so we have to learn how to be happy and content doing things which are helpful to the world, right? and not look at it like, oh, it's going to be so terrible. You know, I can't have my ice cream. You know, I mean, oh, come on. That's a serious concern
with a lot of people.
You're not a victim. You're not a victim. No, there's, 800 million people that are living on diets which are not adequate, that are starving themselves to death. And there's slightly more people than that who are obese. It's like, you know, 800 million people who are starving and 800 people who are obese. That's a very strange situation, you know. There's people all over the world that don't have any food to eat at all. And so it's not about feeling guilty about that or feeling terrible about that. It's just about accepting the fact that we live in the world and that the things that we do in the world need to make sense for the kind of world we want to see in the future.
And that makes absolutely, you know, absolutely makes sense. And I guess, again, this, as you said, is the future of nutrition, because this is the absolute truth.
Right.
Yeah. Great. So thank you, Bill. It was really a very, you know, deep food for thought kind of first session. And I am done with my questions. Anything that you think, you know, you would want to add on before we wind up the session?
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Bill. Thank you. Thank you so much for being
here. Take care.
It was really a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye now.